Now do I start talking? Someday I'll actually learn the format of the show. This is Colin McEnroe. John Dankosky, as many people know, is very heavily involved in the Renaissance Fair movement. There's a huge Renaissance Fair in Spain right now, so he and his wife Jen are there. I believe John is a wizard this year, and Jen, I know, is very involved in women's jousting. So they won't be back. Well, I don't know. Who knows when they'll be back? I mean, they could just decide to live that way for the rest of their lives. But meanwhile, I'm inadequately guest hosting here. And we have, in order to compensate for that, the best possible panel we could get our hands on, starting with Daniela Altomare, State House reporter at the Hartford Courant, Bilal Sikku, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Hartford, and the inimitable Dr. Daniel Haar, editor and columnist at Hearst Connecticut Media. We also have in the studios today the excellent cameras of the excellent CTN. So this show that you're hearing on the radio right now will eventually be on CTN. I think we follow the new detective series that they have, Griebel and Loretti, which I understand is very good. It's kind of a Starsky and Hutch kind of thing.
But it took no government aid.
No, they got nothing. No grant for that series. All right, so we're going to start with the candidacy of Bob Stefanowski. He's running against Ned Lamont. I mean, we'll talk about both of them, I guess, and we'll talk about Oz Griebel, too, as far as that goes. But I think we're going to start with this idea, and Dan, I'll have you get us started on this, that Bob Stefanowski, who has no background in politics, you know, there are sort of indications that he doesn't really know how to run a campaign or how to run as a candidate. He seems a little unfamiliar with money raising. He seems a little unfamiliar with debating, although we'll come to that. But there are also questions about whether that's a liability anymore. Candidates who are non-traditional candidates who don't hit all the typical tropes of political campaigning often do well in this environment.
I don't think he's going to be handicapped by his inability to do the traditional trappings of a campaign. I think he may be handicapped by the fact that he's so far to the right in his one issue, and it is just the one issue. It's really just one piece of one issue. A one-issue candidacy would be broad here. That may hurt him, I think, more than the fact
that— Are you going to tell us what the one piece of one issue is?
Well, he wants to eliminate the income tax, yeah. Yes. I was going to get to that, okay. Colin. Yes. He wants to eliminate the income tax, and he wants to eliminate it within 8 years, and he wants to do it without adding back any taxes and also without cutting into education aid to towns, although he hasn't promised that he won't cut other aid to towns. And so this, as is the case with one-issue campaigns, this becomes the venue for debate, and his only attack on Ned Lamont is he's going to raise your taxes, and he'll pretty much pick any tax. So I think he's getting out enough on the airwaves. I think his money problems are probably going to be bigger than his inexperience problems because, as we know, obviously, from the national scene and other campaigns on the left and the right in states, not having been a candidate, not having voted, for example, we know that he didn't vote for 16 years. That doesn't seem to have hurt him. Those are less important than I think where you stand on the spectrum, and I think he may find himself further to the right than he had wished come November 6th.
Although, Bilal, and you have a interesting perspective on this as a political scientist watching the press tries to hold candidates accountable for this stuff, right? You're going to eliminate the income tax in 8 years. How can you possibly do that without completely handicapping virtually everything that the state does? I think there's a question about whether there's a connect or a disconnect between the press saying that and the voters absorbing it, because a lot of voters just like the sound of no more income tax.
Right, and I think you're right about that. Voters here in Connecticut, especially Republican voters, complain a lot about income taxes, but I imagine that it's also a complaint that goes across the political spectrum. And so lots of people are living in a state that is incredibly expensive to live in, rent is high. People are worried about, you know, jobs in the future and the ability to afford to live in the state, property taxes. And so that kind of message of getting rid of the income tax sort of resonates with, I think, a lot of people. But I think the reality of getting rid of that is just it's a non-starter. I think, you know, given the importance of the income tax to the state budget and how it funds so many things that the state tries to do, you simply cannot do it. What's interesting to me about this, I think on the one hand, this is kind of the nightmare scenario for the Republican Party. They have a candidate who has no governing experience and an inability to raise money, who hasn't sort of switched into campaign mode. you know, for this general election. And that's kind of a nightmarish scenario. On the other hand, though, I think, you know, there is an opportunity to win over unaffiliated voters with this message about shrinking the size of government and reducing the cost of government. But I think at the end of the day, he has made a promise that he will inevitably break because he simply will not be able to do what he says he plans to do, which is to get rid of the income tax.
You know, Danielle, there's sort of a cycle here that kind of we're part of. And what happens is we get in touch with our Republican sources. The Republican sources have been having meetings and breakfasts with Stefanowski, and they're coming out, town chairman and longtime big players in the party. And they're going, he doesn't know anything, and he's not really campaigning. And he doesn't have any money, and he doesn't really like raising money. He doesn't know how to do anything. And then we absorb that message, and because we've also covered a lot of campaigns, and we're sort of familiar with what we think a campaign is, we go, oh, wow, Stefanowski, he's just like he's done. He doesn't know how to do this. But the truth is we might all be wrong about this. We were wrong with a guy named Donald Trump who also did not seem to know how to do any of the conventional things about campaigning.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the larger point that the professor just made about, you know, breaking promises, I mean, you know, sure, you know, the income tax, I think John Roland promised to repeal the income tax back in the mid-90s, right? You were around then, I wasn't. But, you know, that's – but really, what is Ned Lamont promising, and what kind of – you know, he's not going out there making a bold promise that he's going to repeal a major source of funding for the state. But, you know, I think – look, the current governor, Malloy, made some promises and certainly went back on those regarding raising taxes. So, you know, I think nobody really has any good answers. I don't know if it's fair to single out Stefanowski in a way that, you know, the other.
It's very fair.
Well,
of course it's fair.
First of all, could I just say, do you like the way she said you were around then? You know, because we're getting pretty close to, hey, Colin, what did Wilbert Cross do about this when it came up? Dan. I've been reading as fast as I can Bob Woodward's book, Fear, and it goes through a lot of this kinds of stuff. And at the beginning of the book, you sort of see Trump being vetted as a campaigner and ultimately being a campaigner. And it's amazing how many things, sort of business guy who seems to be doing this not out of some involvement with public policy and public service prior to this, but just because he's like ready to do something different, very much like Stefanowski, not familiar with a lot of the conventions of campaigning, very much like Stefanowski, not really a diehard Republican in any particular way. In the book, we see Republican insiders saying, you know, you've actually given more money to Democrats and, you know, and they go through all this stuff. And I'm thinking, Stefanowski. And of course, it didn't hurt Trump's. Stefanowski doesn't have Trump's gift with crowds or anything like that.
But Trump without the charm.
But you think you see a parallel too?
Well, there are parallels. It's important to see the differences, and Donald Trump is able to get out on the hustings and charge up a crowd in the way that we have not seen Stefanowski do yet. And unless he does do that, the sort of the ultimate parallel will collapse because that was Donald Trump's. That's the reason he's president. But I did see, for example, we've all reported that Stefanowski was a Democrat. When he came back from an overseas long stint in, I believe, London, he registered shortly before the 2016 election in October of 2016 and was a Democrat registered in Connecticut until July of 2017. So those are the 9 months, similar to the 18-minute gap and, you know, the 9 months in question. So we've all asked him about it. And when I asked him about it on tape, he absolutely refuses to concede on tape that he was a Democrat. And so the question goes like this. Okay, Mr. Stefanowski, why did you come back? If you have all these beliefs that so much align with the Republican Party, why did you come back to the U.S. and register as a Democrat? And his answer is, I registered as a Republican because that's where I belong. And so, no, I understand why you're a Republican now. Why did you register as a Democrat initially? The reason is because I looked at my philosophies and the way I was thinking, and I talked to a lot of people, and the Republican Party is where I belong. And so Mark Pazniokas, our colleague from the Mirror, came up and had the same question. I turned to him and I said, you know, we've already tried this. And my only conclusion is that he simply doesn't want to. I believe, unlike Trump, that he does see reality. I don't think he has a psychological flaw in which he doesn't see reality. He doesn't seem that way to me. But he maybe doesn't want to admit on tape that he was a Democrat, even though we have all reported it, and it's fact.
Well, but sometimes people are reluctant to do, say things that can be turned into commercials. The sound of your own voice saying something is more harming to you than somebody else saying it. It could be what they're thinking. Not that you would ever make your tapes available to for commercial purposes. But anyway, okay, so now we're going to play a game. I don't know if it's exactly a game. But so Daniela has a piece in the Hartford Courant today. It's sort of a tale of the tape thing, like a pre-boxing match. You know, there is, in fact, a debate tonight in New London. A lot of people think that the real campaign is going to start right now. We're going to get Lamont and Stefanowski on stage talking to one another. Let's see what they're going to say. So I have provided Daniela a physical copy of her article in case she forgot what she wrote. And well, I would need that if I were in her shoes. So so she's going to bring up a thing, and then you guys are going to react to it. So get us started.
Well, we were just looking at sort of, you know, what should viewers be watching tonight if they happen to tune into the debate, which will be airing on, I think it's My 9 or whatever that channel is called.
I don't know what that
at
is.
At 7 p.m.
My
9? My TV 9, sorry. at 7 p.m. Things to watch for, you know, how many times will we hear Bob's Trumpanowski? That's the Lamont Democrats' nickname for I'm sorry, Bob Trumpanowski. That's their nickname for Stefanowski. And then Ned Malloy rolls off the tongue a little easier. How many times will these two surrogates sort of come into play for
right.
the candidate?
So that's the thing worth considering. And I've been thinking a lot about this too, Bilal. You watch the Stefanowski commercials, and the number of Stefanowski commercials that mentioned Dan Malloy is so extreme, such a high percentage of them, you almost feel like he doesn't know who he's running against. Obviously, he does know who he's running against. So and the Trump stuff is there in Lamont's campaign rhetoric and commercials, but maybe not quite as consistently. So I ask you, like, you know, I mean, it is ultimately Lamont versus Stefanowski.
Right.
Malloy and Trump aren't in this race. So on how relevant is the constant invocation
right.
of them?
Well, you have two very unpopular politicians in the country, Dan Malloy in his own home state and Donald Trump nationally for most Americans, right, unpopular. And so trying to link Lamont to Malloy to me sounds like a really brilliant tactic. A very unpopular governor, a governor who has a sort of a history among his detractors for raising taxes and creating the fiscal problems that the state faces. And so running against him makes a lot of sense. Running against Donald Trump as well, someone who is incredibly unpopular nationally, linking a Stefanowski to him makes a lot of sense. And so in that sense, I think it's a good thing. But on the other hand, I think voters in Connecticut want to know how we are going to deal with the fiscal problems of the state. And to the extent that these candidates become so distracted running against the past and, well, the present White House occupant, it takes away from really talking about the critical needs the state has with job growth, with dealing with the fiscal problems of the state, the infrastructure of the state, its urban communities. And so that's the potential harm if this goes too far.
Dan, what about this? I particularly feel like Lamont has an opening here to say, hey, Bob, you're running against me. How about why don't you try running against me? You're not running against Dan Malloy. Is that going to work?
Once again, the details matter. In this case, Lamont is saying if we elect Stefanowski, we're electing somebody who is a supporter of Donald Trump. That is a fact. Stefanowski is saying if we elect Lamont, we are electing a protege, his word, protege of Lamont, of Malloy. Not true as far as I can tell. The only connection between them is that they ran against each other in the 2010 primary. I don't know that Lamont, I believe he was on the state investment advisory board before Malloy's term. I could be wrong. I believe it was before Malloy's term. So that connection between them is tenuous. But the point is how people feel. There are so many facts swirling around that get in the way. My sense is that they neutralize each other. The Trumpanowski, Dan Malloy, Ned Malloy back and forth. I think they more or less neutralize each other.
I mean, it is – neither one of them has ultimately dealt with that charge from the other, Daniela. You know, I mean, and sooner or later they're going to have to do this.
Yeah, and I think when you look at Republicans who have been successful in states that are lean more heavily independent or Democratic, like Charlie Baker in Massachusetts, they've done well by creating some distance between themselves and the president. And I don't think that Stefanowski has created a great deal of distance. I mean, there is that commercial that Lamont is running. I think it's Lamont, or is it an outside group? I don't even know. But, you know, who's claiming that Stefanowski gives Trump an A+ or an A rating or something like that.
Lamont, yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, I think in order to be successful in the sort of the Charlie Baker mold, you think he would have to create a little bit of space between himself and the president.
All right. Well, what's the next thing on your tail of the tape? You have to turn to the jump, I think. Either that or you remember it. But if I don't remember anything I ever wrote. So.
Well, I think, you know, one question some people might have, there are three other candidates on the ballot, two third-party candidates who are polling very low. And then there's Oz, who is also polling fairly low. I think he was at 4% in the Quinnipiac poll. Talking about Oz Griebel, he is not in the debate. He was not invited, I think, because of his – I think they said a threshold you had to be at 10%, and he was at 4%. So he won't be participating in this debate. That's a real hardship for him in terms of getting his name out there, getting that exposure. That could really hurt him.
Not the only hardship that Oz is facing today.
Yes, I was just gonna.
Do you want to fill that in that gap?
I love Oz. I've known Oz for 25 years. He's a stand-up guy and he's a smart guy, and I think he in the right universe he could be a great candidate for governor. This is not that right universe. He had I don't know how to pronounce the name, Chorney of the New London Day op-ed editor, Chorney.
Oh. But I don't know either.
Whoever he is, I agree 100% with him in defending why Oz is not in this debate. You've got to show if you're going to be in a mid to late September debate, this is not the primary season. You've got to show that you've made some headway. And Oz, unfortunately, hasn't made headway. He's not going to wake up on January, 9th, as governor. And the reason that he's going to be muzzled is because he doesn't have any money to get his voice out. Way more important than whether he's in any or all of these debates. And, you know, again, he simply wasn't able to raise money. It's not about the popularity directly. It's about the money.
Well, also, his campaign manager was charged yesterday with embezzling, which is like another problem. Not from Oz, but from a previous employer. Although, Bilal,
how could he have?
Yeah, but that's right. There wouldn't be anyone. Well, and to that point, I don't know. This reporter from the Yale Daily News called me up last night to ask about this. And I said, well, it's like, you know, if your dirigible is flying at 14,000 feet and it springs a leak, you got a real problem. If it's 5 feet off the ground and it springs a leak, it's not as big a problem. So the fact that he's got this problem in his campaign right now, or his campaign manager got arrested, isn't as big a thing. But, you know, Bilal, from more of a substantive point of view, there's a way in which Griebel, if he were on stage at the debates, could conceivably keep everybody a little bit more honest. If you look at the way that he's laid out the issues, it's been a little bit more helpful.
Yeah, you know, actually, I'm of the opinion that if someone is on the ballot, they should have an opportunity to speak to the public, and they should have an opportunity to have a forum in which they can have an exchange of ideas about how they would fix some of the problems that the state is confronting. I think at the end of the day, we have a two-party system, and there's really a monopoly on power in this two-party system between the Democrats and the Republicans. There are a lot of reasons, from ballot access rules to other kinds of things, that make it difficult for third parties to gain some traction in our political system. And so if you've got candidates who have been able to go out there, and there are voters in the state of Connecticut who've been willing to sign a petition to put them on the ballot, that I think they should have an opportunity, like any other candidate who is on the ballot, to be able to express their views. And so for me, that forum needs to be created. I understand about the issue of viability. But on the other hand, these are people who are on the ballot, and I think they should have a chance.
Yeah, well, otherwise, the rules become this kind of arbitrary fairy tale. Quit, you got to have 10% in the polls and bring a lily that was growing at the feet of a giant and a feather from a magic plover or something. Right. I mean, they just can make up whatever set of criteria they want. I mean, on the ballot seems like a nice, good bedrock place. You know, Danielle, just quickly back to the campaign manager thing. The one thing that you do have to say about this is one of the ways that we evaluate candidates who have never served in office is how they run on their campaigns, what kind of staffing choices they make. So from that point of view, this is kind of a material issue.
I guess. I don't know if the average person cares who, you know, I mean, obviously, you know, you don't want someone who is arrested for embezzlement. That's a bad thing. And I think people can relate to that. But in terms of, you know, who's running your campaign or how you're running your campaign or, you know, how you're dealing with the press or any of that kind of stuff, I think a lot of that's just inside baseball.
No, the average person is waiting for Loretti and Griebel to come on. They're not even watching this on CTN right
exactly.
now.
Exactly.
So you want to give us at least one more thing from the tail of the tape there?
Well, I think the other question is, you know, really, how do the candidates react? Do they play it safe? Do they stick to their script? I mean, you know, as Danny laid out just a few minutes ago, you know, Stefanowski has really harped on his plan to eliminate the income tax and tried to tie Lamont to, you know, higher taxes. He's been sort of relentless on that, and tolls as well, right? Those two things.
Even though he doesn't support tolls, broad tolls.
Yeah.
Right.
Lamont doesn't.
Correct.
Yeah. But those are the themes. And, you know, Lamont has talked about his plans to create jobs and his, you know, how he's got a business background and that kind of thing. So do they veer from those themes and go into new territory, or do they just hit the same old things over and over again? And really, does it even matter? Like, who cares? You know, do debates matter? Do people watch? Do they change votes? Do they, you know, we're thinking this is a big deal. This is their first, you know, one-on-one face-to-face debate in the general election or ever, really, right? So it's a big deal. But is it really? Does anyone care?
Let's go to the political scientist on that one.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I think there's a range of issues that get raised now post-primary season that I think everyone needs to try to address. And so I think this issue of staying narrowly focused and really sticking to their themes, those may be themes that really worked well during the primaries. They may not be the kind of themes that unaffiliated voters and also voters from the other party who might be willing to vote for a candidate of the opposing party would like to hear. And so I think, you know, these should be an opportunity, and some of this obviously goes towards reporters being able to ask really good questions of these candidates and forcing them to get out of their box and to really answer questions perhaps they don't feel comfortable with. And I know Colin has appreciated the depth of answers these candidates have given over the months. And so, you know, this is an opportunity for, you know, the reporters to really push hard to get them to provide some details. Stefanowski needs to explain if he's going to cut that much money from the budget, how does he do it? You know, Lamont needs to explain, you know, about how he's going to protect, you know, public education at the local level and keep property taxes from going up. I mean, make them explain these kinds of things. And I think that's important to do.
So one of the things that has wrecked debates, Dan, is pivoting. And one of the questions I'll have watching this debate is how handled at all is Stefanowski? If he has handlers, I mean, we know from the book, is it Game Change? Is that the one about Sarah Palin where they just teach her how to pivot? If they ask you a question about whether, you know, ferrets should be vaccinated, just talk about whatever the hell it is.
They couldn't teach her where Kuwait was,
right.
though.
Yeah, but like, don't talk about that. Say something and then immediately pivot towards something you actually know something about, something you have a prepared answer for. Now, Stefanowski, who's a very raw green debater, you know, there'll be somebody trying to handle him on that. But there's also questions about whether he can be handled. That's one question that I'll have watching this is, you know, did he bother to learn how to do that? Or is he going to shoot from the hip per Daniela?
I keep bashing Stefanowski, but he's a super smart guy who thinks on his feet and generally knows the facts, at least about he may not say the facts, but he knows them. At least he doesn't know the operations of state government. And I think where he'll get hurt is if the debate questions turn to details about what he might do. In terms of the sort of big picture, I think he'll be able to answer any and all questions. You know, really, I'm in the Jepsen camp on the debates. You can lose, but you can't win. And everybody is looking for a gaffe. I don't think that pivoting is going to hurt him, A, because he thinks pretty quickly on his feet, and B, because people just don't care about that.
Is that something George Jepsen said?
George Jepsen said it, yes.
Yeah, all right.
Yes.
Well, if George Jepsen says it, it's probably true.
Yeah, he did.
We're going to take a little break right now. We're going to come back with more of this excellent panel after the excellent break we're about to have. All right. We are back. And when I say we, first of all, if you're just tuning in, John Dankosky is at a Renaissance fair in Spain where he is dressed as a wizard. I'm trying to get some pictures. He has a Tumblr, I think. Joining me in studio, I'm Colin, by the way, and I'm hosting inadequately. Daniela Altamare is with us, a state reporter, State House reporter for the Hartford Courant, Bilal Sikku, Associate Professor of Political Science at University of Hartford, and the inimitable Dr. Daniel Haar, editor and columnist at Hearst Connecticut Media.
Colin, what's on your show today?
Oh, thank you for doing that. So I'll just quickly say that what we were trying to do today, we had a different show plan, and then we decided it wasn't the way we wanted it to be, so we pushed it ahead in the calendar. And we decided what we would do is find people who are trying to binge read Fear, the new Bob Woodward book. I am now trying to binge read it. I'm not going to finish it in time for the show, but Susan Campbell already has finished it, a columnist for the Hartford Courant and other things as well. Jacques Lamar, I don't know where he is in it at this point, but he's doing his best. We'll find some other people. We're going to take some calls. We'll also talk to, I think, somebody from Publishers Weekly about the kind of impact a book like this has, the way it just turns into this kind of self-feeding tsunami at the bookstore and online and stuff like that. It's hard to get a copy of it at this point unless you do it digital. All right. So as long as I'm plugging things, can I also mention that on Saturday night I will be at CT Improv doing my yearly appearance with them where we do a combination of stand-up comedy, sort of improvised stand-up comedy and then improvised improv after Kyan Wolf's show. She'll also be there at CT Improv doing Asking for a Friend. I just would like to say that if you're planning to go to my show, do not bring children to my show. My show is not appropriate for children. I'm going to say bad words. I'm a bad person. I keep it as submerged as I can on public radio, but I won't there. Okay. Now that'll get people to come out. All right. So back to topics. So, Dan, you know, it is interesting when there's like some kind of not entirely anticipatable hot potato that gets dropped into the middle of a political season. And I don't even know how significant this is, but UConn has dropped 4 spots in the U.S. News and World Report rankings. It's gone from 18 to 22. Everybody is sort of running around pointing fingers. Susan Herbst is pointing fingers at the legislature, and I think the Republicans are pointing fingers at Susan Herbst, and the Democrats are pointing fingers at the Republicans. Have I missed any fingers?
Malloy's fingers.
Yeah.
Yeah, you always have to have his fingers in there. So let's start with the idea that UConn isn't any different now than it was 3 or 4 years ago. It's not these changes happen so gradually, and 4 places in the US News rankings are certainly within the margin of error, I would say. Mm-hmm. So we have to start by saying that there hasn't been a cataclysm at UConn, despite the fact, as Susan Herbst pointed out, that we are underwriting UConn by $168 million less now than we were 6 years ago. And that $168 million is not insignificant. But I think when you look at it, first of all, it's in the context of more than $1 billion, I believe. Second of all, it's lots of other things have happened. And so universities need to, and Bilal will speak up, I assume, on this. Universities need to learn how to cut back a little bit, right? They are the last bastions of great waste in society, and it's ridiculous. and nobody is willing to say this. It's absurd.
Actually, Len Fasano has been willing to say
that. Yeah, I understand. But Len Fasano has been willing to say things like, yeah, we should respond by adding a course to each professor in the semester when he's proposing it. Right, so you have to talk about realistic solutions over a long term. This is not a, hey, how can we save money this year type of thing. This is a change in the culture. And I've talked to Susan Herbst about this, and it's really – her argument is that all those layers of administrative people that we see are not the problem. The cost is science. Mm-hmm. And you can't cut back on science or you lose your people. And so these are big, almost intractable but not intractable problems that I think the issue – scratches the surface of. But look, the Republicans are right. UConn needs to be more efficient. The Democrats are right that you need to keep paying the money.
All right. Well, it is a little – I mean, I don't know whether we can take Susan Herbst's word for the fact that administrative bloat, which is Len Fasano's favorite word to use about this now, is no problem at all. In 2012, Bloomberg did an article about this problem sort of, you know, nationwide. And I think they picked on Purdue first, but then they went to UConn. They didn't even know that UConn had just hired a new publicity mogul for $227,000. But they did point out that they had a $312,000 a year provost and 13 vice deputy and associate vice provosts, including one overseeing engagement, who makes almost $275,000 a year. That was in 2012. The university has 7 vice presidents and 13 deans. President Susan Herbst, who receives $500,000 salary, once again, that's in 2012, has a $199,000 chief of staff.
And a newly created office of the general counsel, which used to be under the attorney general's office.
Right. So one thing that I wonder, Danielle, as you session after session after session, UConn gets discussed the way anything, any budget thing gets discussed. Do you feel as though it gets discussed differently? I mean, is it a little less of a sacred cow, maybe, and a little bit easier to swing the axe at it?
I feel like it is. I feel like there has been a little bit of a sea change. I remember, I think it was last year, during the budget discussions, and Melissa Gibran, a state rep from the lower Connecticut River Valley, was talking about UConn having the UConn employees getting this perk where their kids can go, I think, at a very steep discount, if not for free tuition. And I did a lot of research into this, and I don't remember the details because I barely remember the story I wrote last night. But we looked into it, and this was a perk that UConn staff had, that University of Michigan, University of North Carolina, these public Ivies that UConn likes to compare themselves to, do not have. And, you know, Representative Gibran, I think she's a UConn, or she was a UConn parent, or one of her kids was going there, and she was like, wait a minute, it's not a huge sum of money, but it's very symbolic. And, you know, when you see, you know, university trying to reach out, make itself more affordable to people who, you know, maybe first-generation students who can't, whose parents can't afford to go to college, and you see this, you know, this nice little perk for faculty and staff, it does sort of raise some questions. I think those are the things the legislature is beginning to answer. There are an awful lot of UConn grads, UConn Law School grads, in that building over there at the Capitol I'm pointing to. you know, for a long time it was sort of a sacred cow, but I think there is a growing sense perhaps of impatience. Then you have the CSUs, who are, you know, in some ways always the poor stepchildren of UConn, and UConn gets lavished with, you know, with money and resources, and the CSUs, state university system, is scrambling and fighting to stay alive. So I think, you know, I do sense a little bit of a change.
Right. And well, UConn never had a better friend than Tom Ritter when he was speaker, and Tom Ritter's not speaker anymore. Right away, there's a problem. I don't know, Bilal, where are your thoughts going?
So much to possibly say. A lot was thrown out there. You know, as someone who works in a university environment, and, you know, as an example, in response to Daniela, you know, we have a program where faculty members, if our kids go to a college that is a part of a consortium of other institutions, then our kid can go for free tuition, room and board you pay for, and that a kid from another college could come, for example, to the University of Hartford, you know, tuition free. And, you know, some obviously on the outside, people see this as, you know, perks, but within the institution, this is, you know, something we see in terms of how we value employees who have been there for many, many years, and many of them will try to advance their education as well and get that kind of
a
discount.
Private institution,
right.
As opposed to public taxpayer funding.
Yeah, but there are a lot of public institutions that do it as well. I mean, certainly there are ones who don't do it for a variety of different reasons, and they've sort of made those choices. And it's actually something that I will defend. I mean, you know, I've been at the University of Hartford now. This is the start of my 17th year. I love it as an institution. It has been a great place to work. I wish my daughter had gone there instead of Howard, because it's cheaper. But, you know, nonetheless, I mean, that's something that's there. I mean, I think in general, you know, when you think about the rising cost of higher ed, and I think it's very difficult to, on the one hand, justify the kind of cost. And I think we need to think about how we, as a society, think about the importance of higher education and the role it plays in, you know, in creating people for our workforce, and also, more importantly, creating citizens for our society and giving them access to liberal arts education and not just training them for jobs, that it becomes critically important that we make the investments we need to make in higher ed. And I think we just simply as a society have failed to do that. Everything is more expensive than it used to be. Going to the doctor's office is more expensive. Going to the dentist is more expensive. everything has grown, higher ed. And if you really look at the numbers and you dig very deeply into those numbers, you'd be stunned to find out that in some of those areas, the costs have gone up in a very dramatic way that, while not quite the same as what has happened to higher ed, especially since the 1980s, but it has gone up and has become increasingly expensive. And I think it's really easy to sort of use higher ed as a punching bag in our society. And I think that's unfortunate because I think we play a very vital role.
We're going to have to go to a break right here. We're going to come back with more of this panel. We're going to say farewell, a sad farewell, to somebody who was an occasional Wheelhouse panelist, too. All right. We have to say a sad farewell to somebody who did occasionally appear on the Wheelhouse in its early years and was a political kind of analyst and contributor to our show at large, our shows, our station at large, Ben Duval. I actually started to get to know Ben Duval in the 90s. He was a close associate of Lowell Weicker. That was one of the ways that I first got to know Ben. Usually when Lowell Weicker would come to my old studios at WTIC, he'd be accompanied by Ben and Tom Dudchick. Ben and I stayed in touch for a very long time in a lot of different ways. I was with him in 2000 in Philadelphia when he was leading the McCain delegation into a not particularly welcoming environment where they were all supposed to switch over to George W. Bush and they didn't want to. But the important thing about Ben was he was the kind of political operative who didn't let politics get in the way of his humanity. I'm going to take the liberty of telling a quick story that that was sort of maybe I'm not even supposed to tell, but I think it's a good story. So there was one night here, we were doing election coverage. John and I were anchoring it, and Ben was being a Republican analyst. Bill Curry, also a regular panelist here on the Wheelhouse, was doing the Democratic analysis, and they kind of got into it a little bit, and tempers flared up a little bit in a way that's not entirely customary for either one of them. What's interesting about that is that Bill, who is the kind of person who does this kind of thing, the next day called Ben and said, and just said that he felt really bad and he wanted to take responsibility for his part in all this. And they apparently talked for 2 hours and then became very, very close. And that's like a very Ben Duval kind of thing too. You know, I mean, it would be rare to see him get bad anyway. But for he and Bill, very typical for both of them to have a 2-hour conversation and then stay close after that. There are a lot of stories like that floating around, people who knew Ben. So he was riding in a charity event, a bike riding event for Smilo Cancer, and his heart gave out. And he had a big heart, and we will definitely miss him here. So just let's hear his voice, maybe not for the last time on the station. I hope not, but for one of the last times here, here he is. I believe this is on the occasion of John McCain's death.
I think it's a lesson learned. And, you know, he was not, you know, this pejorative term people use called rhino. He was not a Republican name only. You go down and look at his voting record, he's as conservative as one comes. But you can be you know, loyal to your issues and loyal to yourself, but do so in a way that's respectful and in a way that can possibly bring more people on your side. I remember him talking about this because he said, you know, the people that support you. Your job is to convince those in the middle because those that are opposed to you probably aren't going to change. So if all you're going to do is tell people they're wrong, you're not going to build your base.
Okay, so that's a vintage Ben Duval and John McCain, too. All right, so we got time for, I think, a couple more topics here. Danielle, I'm going to flip it over to you for just a second here, something else that you wrote about in the area that is sort of broadly construed as identity politics. There's been kind of a notion that the Republicans just don't do very well at this, that whether we're talking about candidates of color or candidates from the LGBTQ community or candidates who are Latino, that they lag behind. They just don't have as meaningful a big tent as they would like to have. And so you wrote about the fact that here in Connecticut anyway, on the LGBTQ front, there are some pretty significant numbers all of a sudden candidate-wise.
Yeah, there's been a lot of discussion nationally about this, quote, rainbow wave of candidates. There are a lot of out LGBTQ candidates running for seats across the country, you know, from Congress in Kansas to, you know, Vermont having the first trans nominee for governor, Democrat. And most of those candidates, almost all of those candidates, are Democrats. Here in Connecticut, we have at the legislative level, particularly in the House, there are 5 out gay candidates running for House seats, and they're all Republican. There's another out gay Republican running for state Senate. So in the legislature, currently right now, the Republicans have 0 openly gay candidates serving in the legislature, and they could potentially, if all of them win, they could have 6.
Yeah, including in our district, Danny, where you and I live, right?
That is true. That was an upset.
Danny and I don't live together as a gay couple. I don't know if that seemed that way, yes, but we do live in the same district, right?
Yeah, that was a bit of an upset. I'm looking.
Well, no, but Mary Faye, I think is her name. She's the one. She would be running against Gilchrist.
Yeah, she's
and she's a gay Republican.
Yeah, I'm not focused on this issue because I'm looking for the day when it and obviously we're not there yet. I hope we are there soon when these sorts of things just simply don't matter. I'm talking about sexual orientation here, not race or age and that sort of thing. But it does still matter, and we'll see what happens when a number of Republicans who are gay have to react to the Kavanaugh court ruling on this issue when it comes up, because it will come up. And there are some people who say it's not settled law. I know that the hearings did not settle that question in any way, but it's still an obvious sort of big picture issue. But again, I would like for it to be just as routine as a 2-hour conversation with Bill Curry. I don't think
we asked the candidates running in Connecticut what they thought about President Trump and if they felt like they had to reconcile sort of who they are as people and their lives with what the president's agenda may or may not be regarding marriage equality and other issues. And, almost all of them that I asked said they don't believe that marriage equality is in jeopardy. They don't believe there's any possible way the clock will be turned back. Now, some people may say, perhaps you may say,
the Kavanaugh court may have something. We'll see. We'll see.
Yeah. I think in reading that, piece, I think that was the part of it that really struck me as particularly interesting, is how you deal with a party that has, not sort of something in the background, but really has been in the forefront as a party that's been opposed to same-sex marriage and gay rights, and has a base of supporters within the party nationally, Christian conservatives who also take a very strong position against these kinds of issues. And so how you balance that tension, within the party, being a part of a party that expresses those views, to me, I just thought was really interesting. I know, from my own experience, I teach a course every fall during an election year on campaign elections and voting. And, one of the things I often talk to my students about is just how underrepresented everyone is except white males in power within our society, not only in the corporate sector, but certainly throughout the political sector. And so one of the things that's exciting to me about this election season is to see the number of people who have stepped up to the plate, who have not been the kind of traditional candidates we've seen. And what's particularly exciting about it is that many people who are on the ballot now are really being projected as winners, or very strong winners, or strong competitors. And so this is a very interesting sort of moment we're in, especially given, the Trump election was a couple years ago and how that has affected the body politic of the country.
One thing that I would say is that I think all of this may wind up falling under the umbrella of the breakdown of machine politics in America, that party machinery doesn't control as much as it used to. So in some ways, I think sometimes we talk about these things backwards. It's legitimate, as Dan is suggesting, to wonder what gay candidates think about Trump. But I think also gay candidates are saying, look, I'm gay and Republican. Let Trump deal with that. Mm-hmm. Let Kavanaugh deal with that. And I think that's true whether we're talking about Ocasio-Cortez or Johanna Hayes or a lot of other people too. It's kind of like, oh, no, I'm going to – the machine may have some plan for what the ticket's going to be for, you look across the country on both sides and what's happened in 16 and in 18, it's going to happen again in 20. Are people just saying, you know what, I'm going to make my own video and I'm going to campaign and I'm going to win this thing away from the incumbent and the machine isn't as powerful as it used to be? Hey, did you want to say
the machine is pretty good at adapting to identity politics. Just look at the state treasurer's history in Connecticut.
Right.
There's no – the machine is isn't necessarily Tammany Hall,
right?
You know, a century later.
No, no, but they're not as strong as they used to be. Hey, we just got a few minutes left here, but Bilal, as we were emailing back and forth, brought up a really interesting topic, which is yesterday's 9/11. You have the opportunity to talk to a generation of college undergraduates these days about, you know, how they've processed things that were just sort of baked into their reality as opposed to the adaptations we made. So what are you seeing there?
I mean, I think, you know, one of the things that was interesting to me over the years of talking about 9/11 is that I see different cohorts of students who've come through the University of Hartford. In the sort of earlier cohort, we had people who were directly impacted by it. In fact, one of our students at the university lost her mother in one of the towers. We lost alums who died in the towers as well. And over the years, I had the experience of talking to students who talked about, for example, being trapped in schools and, you know, having nervous parents, phone calling the schools, trying to get in contact with them, and the fear that they were feeling and how that sort of carried on into their life. But the thing that struck me, you know, I talked about this last week a little bit, and I talked more about it, obviously, yesterday, was that I'm dealing now with a group of kids who were either around one or infants or not even born when 9/11 happened. And so this is a very distant memory. But what I was struck by, though, is that they live in the aftermath of 9/11. They live in a much more hyper-surveillance state. And those things that have become normalized for them, you know, for previous generations, we sort of look at these things and we go, I can't believe we've just slid down this rabbit hole that we've slid down. But for them, it seems fairly normal and not something that really strikes them as, you know, too much government interference in our privacy and some of the other things that now we sort of take for granted. And so I was really struck by that, just this change, this sort of loss of memory perhaps with 9/11, and how those things that have, you know, those intrusions into our privacy and other things have become normalized with this generation, that they don't think that it's really that big a deal as much.
Just a few minutes left, and I want to get to the other two panelists, but I'm going to slightly shift this. As you know, one of the things that I was responding to Bilal with, Dan, is that we're looking at the 10th anniversary right now of Lehman Brothers going under, starting this cascading financial crisis. We know how to do observances of 9/11 to this day. You know, you can go to one of the sites and you can read names and stuff like that. This other thing, which I think may affect Bilal students as much, if not more, you know, the way that the financial industry turned out not to be operating on behalf of its own individual clients, is a harder thing to observe. And I feel like it does get swept away.
Well, in a sense, they're two sides of the same coin, which is 21st century, the U.S. attempting, some would say in vain, to maintain its 20th century hegemony in the world. I don't know if I can overstate that. You don't want to forget the fact that we're talking about 3,000 victims here, and that's a very significant difference. And of course, there were victims of the Great Recession as well. That was Saturday, that 10 years ago was Lehman Brothers. I think that if you look at what is the recession, how does it reverberate today? I would guess that these kids that are – most of them are young, right? Are more affected by the recession than by 9/11, even with the loss of sort of personal freedoms that go along with a changed society, because that's really redefined us, not as much as the Great Depression did, but significantly.
About a minute left. I mean, Daniela, one of the things we won't hear probably at the debate tonight, because we have really wealthy candidates, you know. It's hard for them probably to talk about like what needs to be done to rein in the kind of unchecked power in the Wall Street sector that kind of didn't really ever get punished at all after the recession.
But you could probably draw a straight line between, you know, the financial crisis and, you know, then Occupy Wall Street and then some of the things that Bilal was just talking about in terms of, you know, people demanding a seat at the table in politics. Perhaps there's some kind of thread that, you know, these all kind of follow from one another.
All right. Well, we're going to have to kind of begin to wrap things up. I think, by the way, you're going to be subjected to me hosting again next week. This Renaissance Fair in Spain apparently goes on for a really long time. So I think I might be guest hosting next week. But I want to thank everybody who helped out here today, especially, of course, Bilal and Dan and Daniela. Also Scott Breedy. He's the guy who pulls this whole thing together as its producer. Katie Dolarski watches over us. Kion Wolf, as usual, on the board making things sound good. Also, thanks to our friends from CTN. They're in here with their cameras. cameras. As I say, we will be positioned, I think we're following Loretti and Griebel, which is their new detective thriller on CTN. So tune in next week, and thanks for listening today.